Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Aaron Atkinson, registration number 34564. I'm counsel for the appellants in this case, CVR Investors, Inc. and CTS Investments, LLC. This particular appeal follows the hearing de novo in front of the Board of Assessment Appeals, in which my clients protested their real property taxes. The property they own is located in Newcastle, Colorado, and the county taxing authority is Garfield County in the Garfield County Assessor's Office. Through trial de novo in front of the Board of Assessment Appeals thereafter, the BAA held in favor of Garfield County and upheld a valuation on the residential real property of my clients of $30,000 per acre. This appeal is brought by my clients based on two criteria or two elements of fault that occurred in the BAA. One is the BAA failed to give due credence to the most significant transaction that occurred during the statutory base period, which should have borne on value for my client's properties. And two, the county created a flawed time trend model and then proceeded to apply it in an arbitrary manner, which is reversible by this court. The transaction at issue involved the actual purchase, as you've seen from the briefs, of my client, CVR Investors, Inc., who I'll call CVR. They purchased 117 acres approximately in Newcastle. That purchase was for $700,000 on April 15th of 2010. That purchase was effected between CVR and GMAC ResCap. Now, the county in the BAA hearing proceeded to make an offer of proof that that particular transaction had not been consummated at arm's length. The offer of proof is the first element that we call at fault on behalf of the BAA, because it was that based upon evidence that should have been inadmissible. The BAA accepted certain articles that had been printed off of the internet by the county in an effort to infer that there had been undue duress effected upon GMAC in the consummation of this sale. When we began to discuss this matter further in the underlying proceeding, it was stated by Ms. Smith, who was the representative from the assessor's office, that in fact the federal government was effecting this undue duress upon GMAC based upon their lender-borrower relationship under the TARP program. None of the articles that were submitted mentioned CVR. None of them mentioned Newcastle. None of them mentioned Castle Valley Ranch, which is the subdivision. None of them had any correlation whatsoever with the actual CVR transaction. And when pressed, the assessor testified that basically none of the criteria for admissibility had been met, the criteria of the Flower Stop case, for example, and the criteria that were discussed in the 117th Street case as well, criteria being that there is competent evidence. The Colorado statutes say that if there's competent evidence, then that's admissible. Competent being what a reasonable person would rely upon in the conduct of his or her affairs.
Can I ask you about that, Mr. Atkinson?
Yes, sir.
We all get information passed to us by various financial sources, including Bloomberg, which I think was one of the articles involved here. Don't people rely on Bloomberg in making investment decisions? Don't they say, gosh, Bloomberg's telling us that there's going to be a merger that's going to happen between, like, we have Office Max and Office Depot currently. Can't we rely on that information to some extent, even though we know it's just marketplace rumor at this point?
Judge, I think that the reliance would have to be based on something more than just printing the article off the internet, and that's the Flower Stop case. There has to be an indicia of trustworthiness associated with it. We have to have declarants who are available that we can speak to show that the federal government was pressuring and threatening GMAC to sell this 117 acres to my clients. And the fact is that there's a string of inferences there that is not sufficient to be relied upon. The assessor admitted through her testimony that she had spoken with any of the authors of the articles. And that's significant because, as in the 117th and Associates case, you had a situation where the taxpayer didn't show up for the BAA hearing but submitted market reports, which were comparables of the kind that people rely upon in arriving at assessments. But the Court of Appeals in that case said, no, that there's no Flower Stop criteria that were met here. We can't cross-examine how these comparables were put together. We can't find out more information that would validate. And as a result, there's a due process problem there, because in that case, the county could not, over the objection of the county, the BAA admitted those materials. And there simply wasn't a basis. There wasn't a competent evidence that could be investigated.
One of the elements involves the ability to cross-examine the declarants or knowledge that the information is going to be proffered. Wasn't this part of the assessor's original appraisal that had been provided to your client sometime previously?
Yes, Your Honor. The actual appraisal had been submitted beforehand. And as a result, it could have been that my clients could have investigated some of these articles and made phone calls, et cetera. But, Your Honor, when you look at the other side of the evidence that was presented, such as the seller's own agent who testified in the BAA hearing, that there had been no undue duress, that there had been no subjugation of free will, which is something that the duress would require under normal circumstances, that, in fact, this was a duly negotiated deal between two free parties. And cases such as the Maestors case have said that we can't look at this in a vacuum. We have to look at these figures as if it's the free market. It's a willing borrower and a willing seller. And is the selling price something that would actually occur in the free market? And as we've argued in our briefs, this is not something that would have occurred there. The seller's agent testified that this had been duly marketed for months and months, that the prices had been lowered continually to a point where it actually achieved a buyer, when it actually reached the actual range of comparables that my clients submitted in the BAA hearing. And so the actual gatekeeping function that the BAA was charged with maintaining was left open. And these pieces of evidence were not competent insofar as there was no correlation that could be drawn. And if there's no threshold that the BAA understands that they can follow in order to present evidence on undue duress, then the taxpayer is left subjugated himself to a tax abuse situation, because the assessor can raise the white flag of undue duress at any moment. At any moment, such as like the CP and Sons case, which is probably the most factually similar case to this one, the assessor and the BAA could say, well, there's abnormal pressure, and as a result, this is an undue duress situation. But the case law tracking duress in contractual jurisprudence says that there has to be a little bit more. There needs to be more of a showing of subjugation of free will. There needs to be no way out, no other reasonable means, no advice of counsel, for example. And all these things were in existence with the CVR transaction. The Jim Capisalatro was the real estate agent for GMAC, testified that there were several lawyers representing both sides. This was marketed and exposed to the market for months and months and months.
Counsel, can I ask you a quick question? I know you're referring to the contractual domain for duress, for your view of what duress might be. I'm not sure that's so analogous to this situation. I'm wondering if you've done any research either in the state or other states about what undue duress could mean in the context of these kinds of sales.
Your Honor, I've done extensive duress, but it was nothing that had been tracked through the appeal situation in Colorado, for example. I haven't looked at other states and how they treat duress.
Do you think it would be relevant to look at what other states have done in similar situations, or, for example, how they've defined duress, or what is an arm's length sale in this situation?
I think that would be relevant. I think what's important to remember, Your Honor, here is that it's a public policy, is that duress really represents something that taxpayers in Colorado, that residents of Colorado rely upon, that if there's fraud incident to a contract, then the contract's significance is diminished and sometimes avoided. And I don't think that's something that's focused centrally in the trial court level. I don't think the jury instruction 3023 is the only venue in which taxpayers rely upon the duress defense. I think it's a public policy. It permeates the General Assembly and the laws of Colorado. Citizens are encouraged to rely upon free contractual relationships, but if there's fraud incident to a contract, then I think that's the public
policy.
But
if we were to rely on the common concept of duress and avoiding a contract, doesn't that go a lot further? Doesn't that, you know, say that essentially there has to be fraud for there to be duress? And therefore, in tax valuation cases, if there's duress of that nature, we can't consider it.
Your Honor, I think what you have to do is to look at the actual text of the assessor's reference library, which would be a question of law here, and take the plain and ordinary meaning of the words. And what you're describing, duress, is not abnormal conditions, and I think that's the problem with the CP and Stunts case. It's not abnormal pressure.
Counsel, what was the price that the seller paid for the property?
Your Honor, the seller, you were referencing GMAC ResCap?
Right.
The seller to CVR. The seller had actually been the borrower, or excuse me, the lender to Village Homes. Village Homes had purchased the property for many, many more times the value.
Like close to $10 million?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the seller attempted for many months to try to sell the property and kept reducing the price and reducing the price, and then ultimately sold it for a tiny fraction of its original selling price. Doesn't that suggest duress, because a seller who wasn't under duress normally would hold that asset until the real estate market turned?
Your Honor, it might suggest that we need to dig a little deeper, which is what the assessor's office testified to in the hearing, that a purchase price in and of itself cannot be evidence of undue duress, or we cannot toss out a comparable just because it has a low purchase price. You have to dig deeper. And here, in this case, what it really represents is that the price continued to go down, and according to the seller's agent, there were no interested buyers at several different values. And as a matter of fact, I have an exhibit I'd like to distribute if I could, based on the record.
Was it submitted and accepted into evidence?
No, Your Honor, it was not.
We can't consider it then.
Okay. I can describe to you the series of listing prices. It started at $2 million. There were no takers. The price then was dropped to $1.6 million. There were no takers. It went to 1.2, and it wasn't until it got to $1.0667 million that CVR investors became interested in the property. And Your Honor, I think as a matter somewhat a matter of public policy, but just common sense, we have to look at the definition of an arm's length transaction as something that occurs in the free market. This is something that we have to look at in the context of the May Storrs case. It's a willing buyer and a willing seller in the free market. And if there are no takers, and that's the evidence that's developed through the underlying hearing, until it gets to 1.0667, that's what a willing buyer pays a willing seller in the free marketplace. Mr. Capasalatra then testified, as well as Mr. Atkinson, who was the representative of CVR investors, that a change of entitlements was affected, which resulted in the final lowering of the purchase price to the $700,000 that Judge Miller references.
So, and your definition of a willing seller then would include a seller who is in such distress that they need to unload the assets at whatever price they can get.
Your Honor, I think that goes a little far. I think that's probably the outer
bounds. So that's not, you're not saying that.
I'm not saying that. That's correct. What I am saying is that Colorado statutes say that market value is a representative body of sales, including those by a lender. So if we know that the law says just because a lender is selling the property, that doesn't mean that it's an invalid comparable. And we know that the assessor testified that the purchase price alone is not enough to disqualify a sale. We have sort of the outer edge of this analysis, and then we have to dig deeper.
And isn't the key to this is what's a willing seller?
I think that that's certainly one of the most important considerations, yes. I mean, in this particular framework, it is, because that's the undue duress claim, whether GMAC was a willing seller.
I mean, to follow that up, when you've got a property transaction at about $10 million, maybe 2 or 3 years prior to this, and now you've got a sale at $700,000, wouldn't a willing seller essentially say, I can't afford to sell this for $700,000. I'm going to wait until, as Judge Miller said, the real estate market turns. And if you had no borrowing needs that you had to meet, if you didn't have to service debt, for example, why wouldn't that be very important discussion to have as to whether they're really, truly a willing seller?
I think that's an important discussion to have, but I don't think that necessarily leads absolutely to a seller that's been subjugated of his or her own free will. I think that is something that is going to be difficult to draw a bright line rule on, because you're going to have hard bargaining. That's not something that the courts should get involved in. But at the other end of the spectrum is At what point does it become unworkable? At what point does it become unlawful? If you have, there's no dispute here that the base period that my clients were dealing with their taxable values, was a bust period, and that the preceding appraisal period was the boom period. So if we're talking about equities, to draw a series of comparables from a boom period and then try to retrofit them into a bust period is inequitable and arbitrary. And if you look at the values as they were developed by the assessor in the underlying hearing, you can sort of walk yourself through the $30,000 an acre to determine, does this really operate to be an effective value for this property in the free market? So if it's $30,000 an acre, as the assessor's office contends, and it's also evident based on the appraisal that each acre of this land has a capacity of 2.22 units, then we do the math and then we understand there's about $13,500 per unit. That's what a unit, according to the assessor's office, should be worth in Newcastle. Well, if comparable property that is improved, meaning it has infrastructure, it may have water, sewer, tap fees, et cetera, is actually worth approximately $11,000 to $12,000, what the county would have us believe is equitable in a fair, just taxation is that unimproved raw units are worth more than improved lots. CVR owns lots in this area, and that's the nature of the taxation on those lots. So the actual math shows that there's just no equalization of the taxes here. There is no justification for taxing vacant units, vacant land, at a value far and above finished lots with infrastructure. And we haven't even begun to discuss that the record as it was developed showed it's about $42,600 approximately to put the infrastructure into these lots to bring them back to where the improved lots are. There's a gross inequity here, and the numbers don't work.
And is this what you're referring to as the flawed time trend model?
Exactly, Your Honor. The model in and of itself is flawed because it's based on vacant lots. Ms. Smith testified in the hearing that she developed a model based on a series of vacant lots, which we never saw, and that established a trend that allowed her to retrofit these 2006 to 2008 comparables into the 2008 recession period, 2008 to 2010 recession period. And so that's the first issue. It's a flawed model. It's based on lots. These are not like-kind properties. You can't compare raw land, raw vacant land, with finished lots. And secondly, when she got to her values, the math ensued, which I was just discussing, that assessed values per unit in Castle Valley Ranch were approximately $11,000, but unimproved lots were valued at around $13,000. It doesn't make sense. The math does not compute.
Counsel, could you enlighten me about what the record shows or what was presented? Obviously, we have the assessor or the assessor's representative's testimony and her appraisal. Was there a competing appraisal presented, or simply experts or representatives of the seller or less formalized opinion about what the appraised value should be?
Your Honor, we presented an appraisal from Duff and Phelps, who was our expert. That is at documents 8 to 23 in the record.
And that expert was a licensed appraiser in Colorado?
Your Honor, I don't believe he was a licensed appraiser. His qualifications are in the record.
So it seems like if he's not an appraiser, he couldn't have done an appraisal, at least under the strict terminology of what an appraisal is.
Well, Your Honor, the fact is his qualifications were submitted to the BAA, and the BAA found that he was an expert in the practices of appraisal.
No, I don't dispute he might be an expert, but it's not, he didn't do an appraisal that complied with the Association of Appraisal Standards or whatever the Board of Real Estate Appraisal appraisers use. He gave bits and pieces of testimony which may have been very well supported, but there was no competing appraisal done such as the one that the county assessor did.
Well, there is a difference because of the licensed appraisal issue that you just pointed out. But he did do an appraisal and was found to be an expert. And in his findings, there was no evidence that his findings actually violated a USPAP section. There was no actual evidence that was developed, aside from arguments of counsel, that there was a violation there.
Did he assert that his appraisal complied with all the USPAP requirements?
I want to say he did, Your Honor, but I couldn't point you to the record where he did. More importantly, for the purposes of this discussion, I think, Judge Navarro, is the standard of review that we're dealing with is problematic based on the briefing. The fact is that my clients have the burden of proof here in front of you to show that the valuation was incorrect. It's not our burden of proof to show that we were in fact correct. It's that the other side was incorrect. And that's the Sonnenberg case. And that was something that's shown through, I think, in the briefings, and that merits pointing out now, because even if we were to set aside Mr. Van Dossler's testimony about the appraisal, or the analysis, the other mathematical work that he did for this particular property, we still have the issue of the admissibility of the evidence. Because if this evidence is inadmissible, then the CVR transaction is a comparable, and that would drastically affect the value. And secondly, we were using the assessor's office's own figures in developing the cross-examination against her, et cetera. This issue of vacant lots being used to value raw land is based on her own testimony. And it's contrary, that's the elements that are contrary to the USPAP. To take these non-like-kind properties and to try to make them similar to one another.
Let me go back to the admissibility of the evidence question. I take it, was the Ms. Smith, was she accepted as an expert?
Your Honor, I don't recall that she was proffered as an expert, but she was a registered appraiser.
Okay. And an expert can, of course, rely on hearsay or other evidence that's not necessarily admissible, right?
That is correct.
So isn't the question whether or not her testimony was admissible, as opposed to whether the specific documents you're talking about were admissible?
Your Honor, yes, I believe that that's accurate.
And you would argue that it is her testimony was not admissible?
Not on the issues of undue duress, you're correct.
And that was objected to?
Absolutely. And the objection was based upon the due process arguments that I've set forth.
Okay.
The question regarding the undue duress, we believe, is a question of law because it's based upon the interpretation of this free market value definition in the assessor's reference library manual. And if nothing else, the CP and Sons case shows that there was a discussion of abnormal pressures there. And the abnormal pressures that were discussed in CP and Sons were that the seller desired itself to be removed from the project and several other items that were related to that. And based upon the jurisprudence that we cited related to duress, and we're just speaking about duress, we haven't even looked at what undue does to the term duress. These are legal interpretations that should be made by the court.
But didn't the court in CP and Sons essentially say that it's up to the BAA, or it was up to the trial court in that case because it went through the trial court, to decide whether or not there was duress or some indicia of that? That doesn't sound like an issue of law. It sounds like we would review it to determine if there's adequate evidence in the record to support the determination that the finder of fact made.
You're right in part, Your Honor. Firstly, they did say that the district court had the discretion to weigh the evidence. And that was the nature of the appeal, that the BAA had failed to give enough weight to the transaction, the purchase of that particular property. And there wasn't a discussion of undue duress. In fact, the words were never used in the case. They referenced abnormal pressure. And in this case, the question of the interpretation of the manual, of the undue duress in the manual, which is specifically noted in Ms. Smith's appraisal, is a question of law. We have to be able to have a standard to rely upon in order to look forward so that taxpayers can understand that why they're being taxed the way that they're being taxed effectively.
Do we owe some deference to either the assessor or the BAA in their interpretation of the manual?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, the state of Colorado says that there have to be, the Division of Taxation, I believe, that there has to be a manual presented, and assessors are obliged to follow that manual. The court is not necessarily obliged to, but it does give deference to the terminology. Unfortunately, there is no definition in the manual of undue duress, or of either term, singularly. We have to try to establish a threshold so that we understand at what point we get there. And all these discussions about undue duress and whether this is actually a comparable bears on the statute referencing a representative body of sales. Because the CVR transaction was the only transaction in Newcastle, and there is no other problem with this particular transaction, per the record, that would tend to invalidate it as the most comparable sale that occurred in this base period. My clients would ask that the court determine as a preliminary matter that the admission of that evidence was an error. And we have to sort of assume that the evidence was admitted. We have to infer it, because the only thing that the BAA said in its order was that it agreed with the BAA's decision, or the assessor's decision, not to consider the CVR transaction as it was not at arm's length. Again, there's no discussion of undue duress, but in the event that this evidence is found to have been inadmissible, then this transaction should have been considered as bearing upon the tax valuation for my client, both of my client's properties. Your Honor, I think I will reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Cassandra Coleman from Worrell, Direct, Janes and Gavrell, registration number 37370. This case is almost identical to CP and Son that was just discussed, the Boulder County case. In that case, the court found that it had to defer, in that case, to the trial court, but also here it would be to the BAA, as far as the factual determination as to what weight to give the taxpayer's evidence, taxpayer's testimony as to its own sale or its own purchase of the same property. The same thing's going on here. The BAA chose not to give very much weight to the taxpayer's testimony of its own agents and its own people as to the prior purchase of the property. You all have already read our briefs, have already discussed at length that there was a dramatic, it was a fire sale. Between the time the property was originally sold by CTS to Village Homes at close to $10 million, and a few years later, after it went through receivership and then a government TARP bailout to $700,000 being the purchase price that we're talking about now, within about 3 years. There's no better evidence of a fire sale than a situation like that, and it wasn't error to exclude that sale based on the evidence that was there. In CP and Sons, the taxpayer also presented evidence saying this was an arm's length deal, and the trial court gave it minimal value. Here, I believe also the BAA gave the same testimony of the taxpayers minimal weight in considering the evidence.
Counsel, can I ask you a quick question? Do you agree that the BAA found that the transaction issue was not an arm's length sale because it was consummated with undue duress? Is that what you think the BAA found?
Not necessarily. I believe the BAA's 2 or 3 page ruling speaks for itself. It just says the sale was excluded. I don't
believe
it
says
duress.
But was there any other basis for excluding it besides undue duress?
It just was not arm's length.
Was there any other basis for thinking it was not arm's length other than that it might be the result of undue duress?
It would have to be looked at the entire record as a whole, whether there is anything else. There's one sentence in their order saying they agreed with the assessor's exclusion.
Doesn't that impede our review significantly? We don't know what the BAA was actually finding.
I don't believe that that's imperative as to the reasons why they uphold the assessor's value.
Well, if we follow the discussion in the assessor's reference library about what qualifies as arm's length and what doesn't, the definition that I think is in the RL is a sale between unrelated parties under no undue duress or something very similar to that. Clearly, we don't have related parties here. You agree with that?
Not necessarily. They weren't related, but the chain of title that passed from CTS to Village Homes to a receivership to GMAC ResCap and then back to the same parties. They weren't directly immediately related. but the chain of title is also suspicious.
Well, suspicious in what sense? I mean, somebody went to a fire sale and got a great deal on some property, essentially, isn't that right?
Correct.
And is there any indication that the owners of the property here were somehow related or had sway over GMAC?
Beyond that, no. It's clearly any duress. That's why I don't believe duress is the standard. It's not an arm's length transaction. But clearly any duress exercised was the taxpayers through the federal government's funding of this bailout and the pressure from the legislature and the federal government that was put on GMAC to get rid of its vacant land.
Is it your position that the sequence of price changes, you know, the dramatic reduction in price over a course of 3 years, is sufficient evidence in and of itself to show that it was not an arm's length transaction?
It probably isn't, but that the testimony that was up before the BAA from Ms. Smith was that that's what triggered a red flag instead of automatically including the sale in her table of comps. Is that's what raised the red flag for her to dig deeper and look at whether or not it was a truly arm's length sale. That was the first step in her analysis. Simply being an REO doesn't mean that it was a bad sale, but when she dug deeper and saw first that the purchase price was over $1 million, then there was some loss of entitlements, there were some other things going on, and again, the price dropped dramatically. That made her go back and look at the reasons for that. All the articles that were referenced, that's just, those were in her appraisal to support the reason. It wasn't simply that it was an REO sale, it was that there was supporting evidence that this wasn't even a normal foreclosure or a normal REO situation. This was the GMAC bailout.
Was there any evidence in the record that the articles cited in the report by Ms. Smith were the type of, it's reasonably relied upon by appraisers in the field?
I believe she said she usually relies on these. That's part of her ad valorem tax process, is to be up to date on things like Bloomberg, on just generally what's going on in the marketplace. And I'm not sure if she specifically pointed to these sources, but she did testify that she generally stays apprised of news related to real estate transactions, including this.
This property gets valued based upon, I think, a year and a half period generally. That's what we're looking at, the assessment period?
Yeah, it's usually about 18 months.
Okay, so why wouldn't we simply say, all right, whatever the value was before was much higher. Whatever the value is perhaps from today forward would be higher than what they paid because real estate is clearly coming back. But during that 1.5 year period, there's no other evidence of any particular sale. So why are we not saying the market during that 18 month period is what the market was? If there's not a relationship between the parties here, whether or not they had a really motivated seller shouldn't be determined.
Well, that really wasn't what went on. As much as there may not have been these huge land sales of development property, there were sales. This is a golf course community. Just adjacent to it is Lakota Canyon. There were sales on that property of lots. There were sales in Newcastle. There were sales in Garfield County. They were not the same type of bulk land development sales, but there were sales. So to look and say, this is the only sale we had and we use it as the sole comp for market approach would not fit with either use path or with the requirements of the statute to get a representative body of sales. That's why there is specifically, the statute allows for time trending for exactly this reason. It's 39.1104, 10.2D. Specifically allows for time trending when there is a lack of sales or lack of similar sales. That requires the assessors, and the entire office puts together a time trending model based on at least 30 sales and then time trends it back. So the legislature already has contemplated what to do in situations like this, and it's not just take this one sale and use it as market value.
Could you address Mr. Atkinson's contention that about the flawed model, and specifically his contention that the sale of the valuation that was placed on it by Ms. Smith for raw land is higher than what sales were occurring in that timeframe for finished lots.
That's not really the time trend model. That the time trending is specifically what's set out in the ARL and then also in statute. What he's referring to is CBR and CTS, or one or the other, also owns 10 fully built out townhomes, and he's basing it on what those were valued at, which I believe is not actually a market approach. What he's looked at is the cost to build and a cost approach, which is not what was applied here. The comps that are in Ms. Smith's USPAP compliant appraisal dealt with, got to a raw land value. The raw land for that area was $30,000 per acre. This is not truly raw land. There are entitlements. CVR, CTS have gone through city planning. The property is annexed into Rifle. It's very unlikely to be de-annexed. There's school sites out there. Like I said, a whole golf course, there's parks. Most of the area is now developed and is essentially where most people of Newcastle live. So this isn't to say it's truly raw land. It really isn't. There are some entitlements to it, subdivision improvements and the like. There also, the issue with the townhome sales is that there was subdivision discounting given to those lots, and that none of that is in the record, but that also created a difference in the valuation because of the statutory requirement for subdivision discount. So it's not a flawed, the time trending model is not flawed. The fact that these came in at a higher value than what Mr. Atkinson has argued was raw land is actually inaccurate. Looking at the comparable sales table in the appraisal, it reflects exactly how the adjustments were made for vacant land, raw land, and got to about $30,000 or $30,000 per acre. And as I've argued in the brief, that's really a very conservative value. The proper, most of the properties came in a lot higher than that. This is about the second lowest based on the 30,000 that we were seeing in the general area of Newcastle. The comparable sales presented by the taxpayer were not comparable at all. One did not even sell. One had navigation easements, was right next to an airport. None of them were really on golf course communities. Several were on the other side of the river, being significant because they would not have sold to residential purchasers generally, as they couldn't access grocery stores, schools, bus areas, all of that. This is a specific area that the comparable sales are more like a typical residential subdivision than the comparable sales that were presented by Mr. Van Dossler. And again, one hadn't even sold. Several had significant issues with them as far as grading and easements.
Do you have a definition of duress that you'd proffer to us?
I do not. I do not believe it's the same as a contract, the contractual duress definition to forgive for performance. That's not what it is. What is in CP and Sons is what is not an arm's length transaction, and that's exactly what we have here. I don't believe this is a situation of duress. It just simply is not arm's length. In CP and Sons, it basically said it wasn't arm's length because the investor wanted out. Clearly, GMAC ResCap wanted out of this situation, and there were abnormal pressures in CP and Sons. I believe the definition from CP and Sons is the appropriate one to adopt here, that it's not, and it's a negative, but it's not an arm's length transaction if there are abnormal pressures, and such as the investor not wanting to be involved in owning the property any longer. Both of those are clearly here. GMAC was under abnormal pressure from the federal government, being forced into a bailout situation. They couldn't hold the property like a normal willing seller would have held the property until the market picked up again. They had received the property, and they'd also received significant fundings to unload it, basically at whatever price. So as far as, I wouldn't propose a definition of duress, I would propose the definition of arm's length as following the CP and Sons
Can I follow up on that? Now, doesn't the ARL have a definition of arm's length transaction in it?
Kind of.
You seem to be not focusing on that very much at all.
The ARL's definition of arm's length does refer, like we talked about, back to this.
To undue duress.
Right.
So shouldn't that be more important than this case that you're relying on?
I don't necessarily agree with that. Although the ARL is binding on my client and the assessors around the county, it is not binding on the BAA, whereas case law from CP and Sons is.
So you think when the BAA was referring to the term arm's length transaction, it was not thinking of the ARL definition, it was thinking of this court case that it didn't cite?
I actually would agree with that. The BAA is made up of volunteer appraisers who are used to the definition of arm's length and not that context, not necessarily the ARL, which applies to county assessors. So I think there's a broader definition of what is arm's length in the general real estate context where the BAA comes from and is familiar with. While they didn't cite to the CP and Sun case, they are familiar with the case law governing them, which is not the ARL. Again, either party could have called the DPT to testify as to the ARL and its definition. No one did. There was no indication that the BAA then asked its counsel or anyone else to refer to the ARL. And again, that document is binding on my client, is not binding on you, is not binding on the BAA. While it should be given deference, it is not. It really does the assessors of the entire state no help when it's not being used by the courts of appeal, and the courts of appeal coming back with CP and Sons with a different definition, which is binding. So that's why I believe the court of appeals case is also, it's factually on point for one, but also the fact that that decision is binding on everybody.
And you think there's a significant difference between abnormal pressure and undue duress?
I do.
And what's that difference?
Well, because again, undue duress, the case law on it comes from contractual law. This isn't a contract. And the parties would never be in that same relationship. The taxpayer and the taxing authority would never be in a relationship, or it would be really hard to find one that either could cause undue duress on the other, which is an element in the contractual case law, that it has to be the same party causing that undue duress.
Well, if we ignore the case law discussion of undue duress in the context of voiding contracts, let's just forget that for the moment for purposes of my question. We still need some kind of definition to apply. And if you say arm's length, we need to know what that means. And arm's length, according to the ARL, uses this phrase duress. And even though CP and Sons doesn't use the phrase duress, it seems pretty clear that it's talking about something similar, isn't it? Abnormal pressure sounds like duress to me.
Yes, maybe it's duress light is the best way to put it. It's abnormal pressures is not undue duress. Abnormal pressures, I believe this situation fits abnormal pressures, such as the TARP funding and federal government injection of billions of dollars. That's abnormal pressure. Would that meet the standard of undue duress, since it clearly wasn't caused by the taxing authority here? It probably wouldn't, but it does meet the definition of abnormal pressures as that was discussed in CP and Sons. So do we need a definition? If we do, it's there in CP and Sons as abnormal pressures, which maybe refers to duress. But again, it could be duress light because we won't ever meet that standard of the relationship, and essentially the assessor is holding a gun to a seller's head.
Now, I appreciate your reliance on CP and Sons, but of course, as you noted, BA didn't cite that case. And BA, as you said, is also bound by other decisions from this court and, of course, from the state Supreme Court. Some other decisions from the state Supreme Court use the phrase undue duress when discussing market value. Why should we suppose the BA was not thinking about that term when discussing whether this was an arm's length transaction? Why should we focus so singularly on CP and Sons to the exclusion of all other Colorado case law?
I don't think it should be excluded. The court or the BAA didn't refer to any cases based on that, it's fair to say it looked at everything. CP & Sons is simply the most factually on-point case. And it also discusses the other reason I cited it is it really discusses this court's deference to the BAA's decision as to what weight to give the testimony. That case being factually similar, that the taxpayer there too presented evidence that its prior sale or purchase of the same property should have been included. And so I cited it more for its authority that this court should defer to the BAA's factual rulings and that it can only, that can only be overturned absent a showing of any competent evidence. But the reason that, you know, we continue to rely on that case is its factual similarity, whereas the undue duress issue comes up in cases that are not as factually on point as what we have here. Again, I'm, you know, the BAA's findings were on 2 or 3 pages with no citation to case law, which is typical. You know, again, it's coming out of a non-attorney, non-judicial volunteer board.
Ms. Coleman, I'm focusing on the abnormal pressure standard that you're applying. The evidence of the abnormal pressure, I take it, is based on Ms. Smith's testimony about the articles that she read that are exhibits to the report?
So, In part.
And on sort of the sequence of incredibly rapid price decline. Is that basically the basis?
It is. Nobody seriously refuted that. I mean, the taxpayer's position essentially was, yes, we got a great deal at a fire sale, but there was no testimony refuting either that there was this enormous price decline with parties that were continually involved with each other and then the TARP funding.
If the evidence of, so you're saying that the evidence of the, well, let me start again. If we assume for purposes of this question that the testimony about the articles was inadmissible, was the mere fact of the rapid price decline enough to shift the burden to the defendant or the taxpayer to show that there was not abnormal pressure?
The burden was always on the taxpayer to establish that the BOE's value was incorrect. So I don't believe there's any, it's not McDonnell Douglas, we're not at any burden shifting analysis. Basically, when the taxpayer came into the BAA, they needed to, at a minimum, show that the BOE's value was incorrect. It failed to do that. What it needed to do then is overcome the fact that the CVR transaction was excluded, and they failed to meet that burden. There never was a burden on the CBOE to have that. And I mean, as far as exclusion of that evidence, if it really truly wasn't even hearsay, as it wasn't used to establish the truth of the matter asserted, it was used to support the appraisal as to why the CVR transaction wasn't considered. It wasn't necessarily there to show the truth of everything that's in all of those articles. It was merely bolstering the appraisal's opinion that that was not an appropriate transaction to use. Similar to, I know in some of the briefs, there is a reference to the market listings of unsold properties. Those, again, were only used to show the situation of the market and actually to show that those properties were not sold because a willing seller was hanging on to those properties. They weren't used as comparable sales. They were, again, just used to support the appraisal's final opinion of value and why certain transactions were not consummated or were not included in the comps. And I guess just as a final matter, the $30,000 per acre is raw land, which is the market threshold. That was clearly established in the El Paso case against Craddock. And here, like I talked about, this isn't even truly raw land, but the taxpayer has argued that their land should be valued below raw land valuation, which simply flies in the face of Craddock, which is binding. The other Steamboat The Steamboat case that I referenced versus Rapp County BOE also established that this court can only set aside the BAA's rulings if there is no showing of competent evidence. And here I believe there is a showing of competent evidence supporting the BAA's findings, and so it should not be set aside. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. The county is valuing this property as raw land. That's document 31 at page 17. I think there's an arbitrary, it's definitely arbitrary that we can't even establish what raw land is in this case. If you look at Comp 3 that the assessor submitted, that assessed value was $5,700 an acre. And yet the assessor is using it to try to establish a $30,000 an acre. $30,000 an acre assessment on my client's properties via this time trend analysis. It's an arbitrary analysis. If we're at raw land, we're at raw land. Why is there an inconsistency between the two figures? There's no justification. As to the borrower-lender relationship between GMAC and the former owner of the CVR investor's property, there is nothing in the record to indicate any collusion or involvement between the parties that were selling properties over the past 10 years. And what that really brings to light are the cases such as Wiesen v. Short and the other cases involving borrowers and lenders, and whether it's duress for a lender to call a note, which the court has said it's not. That's a contractual right that the lender possesses, and as a matter of law, it could not be duress.
Can I ask you a question following up on what we asked your opponent? Do you think the BAA found or agreed that this transaction was consummated under undue duress?
I do.
Do you think we, as a court, in order to affirm the BAA, have to decide what undue duress means? Or can we follow the line suggested by your opponent that really the BAA was thinking of abnormal pressure as discussed in the CP and Sen case, and therefore we don't really need to define or get into what undue duress means?
Your Honor, the court should make the decision as to what undue duress means. And that's because it's based in the actual language in the assessor's reference library manual, which, as we discussed earlier, is to be given deference by the courts. This is an analysis of really what is a semi-statutory treatise, because the Division of Taxation mandates that this manual be prepared, and assessors are bound to rely upon it, and the court gives it deference. This is important terminology also because if you look in the appraisal, there's a two-page section that Ms. Smith dedicates to undue duress. And as a result, it's a significant phraseology that that the court should offer its opinion on.
Did she ever use the phrase abnormal pressure?
Your Honor, she cited the CP and Sons case. Whether she used that phraseology or not, I do not know.
But she did cite that case.
You're correct.
Okay, thank you.
So in sum, Your Honors, really what this is boiling down to is you're not required to check your common sense at the door. The facts of this case are demonstrated based upon the record that the methodologies used by the assessor to arrive at these values are not mathematically sound. And taxpayers are entitled to rely upon sound taxing methodologies. Otherwise, there's tax abuse. And secondly, this particular issue with the evidence that was presented, the evidence wasn't competent. We'd ask that the court find that it should not have been admitted, that the CVR transactions should have been accepted as a comparable, because failing to accept a comparable that's validly posed is arbitrary based on the case law cited in the briefs. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you an opinion in due course. Before we leave this case, I want to just make a simple disclosure that I have a mortgage that was carried through GMAC. I don't know if that causes any of you any concern, but you're free to contact your clients and see if that causes you any problems. And if you wish to file some kind of motion relative to that, try and get that done by next Monday, if you would. All right. Thank you.